This is Discarded Design, a reflection on art in ephemera. What do a medicine bottle, a ruler, a film reel, and a soda can all have in common? The answer to that question lies within and around the walls of Harvey Hall. Built in 1916, Harvey Hall is the oldest building standing on the UW-Stout campus. From classroom space to faculty offices, from industrial design labs to home economy labs, Harvey Hall has been used for many things over its long history. And as the uses have changed over the years, Harvey Hall has been significantly remodeled many times. The most recent remodeling of the space was in 2016 to mark the anniversary of the University of Wisconsin-Stout. I'm Dr. Ursula Marie Husted. I'm a cartoonist and faculty at UW-Stout. These four graduate students in my Art and Design Research Seminar have explored the history and culture of four out of the many discarded objects found in and around the walls of Harvey Hall. The medicine bottle, the ruler, the film reel, and the soda can illuminate not only the history of the Art and Design program at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, but the journey made by the graduate students themselves as they connect these objects to the world.
My name is Nicolette Morgan. I'm an interior designer and an MFA candidate at UW-Stout. I also earned my undergrad degree at UW-Stout, obviously. I love this place. I also work at an architecture firm in the Twin Cities. During my time as an undergrad, I developed a strong interest for healthcare design. Now, what I find really interesting about it is that it gives design a lot of power and the power to heal through designing spaces that can truly make people heal faster, because a lot of people believe that design is an extra thing, like, oh, if it looks nice or if it does this, that's great, but it's not needed or necessary. But when you start putting facts and numbers to people's healing, they start to take it a little more seriously. When looking through all the items that were found in Harvey Hall, I immediately was drawn to the medicine bottle. I became very interested in how the medicine bottle would have been treated in the 1900s and how interior design may have been related to that, even though it may not have been recognized as, air quotes, interior design at the time. During the recent renovation of Harvey Hall, some interesting artifacts were found in the walls during demolition. One of these items, which was the one that I've chosen, was a medicine bottle from the 1890s. Harvey Hall was first opened in 1916, and it was called the Household Arts Building, and later called the Home Economics Building. You may see an odd timeline going on here. A bottle from the 1890s was found in 2016 in a building that was built in 1916. This peculiar timeline is what triggered a multitude of questions about the bottle itself, what student life was like at Stout when the university was first started, and how medicine was perceived during the time. Let me paint you a picture of what Stout may have been like during that time. For one, it wasn't even called UW-Stout. It was called the Stout Training School. It had two majors, manual training and domestic science. I think that you could probably guess which gender was assigned to the two majors.
Obviously.
Also, this little fun fact might make you cringe a little, but in 1903, the tuition rate was $100 a year for a two-year program.
Wow, seriously? I wish I was part of Stout by that time.
Me too. Hopped on the bandwagon a little too late. Back to the bottle that was found in the wall. The bottle is made of glass and is approximately 3 inches wide and 7 inches tall. It is oval-shaped with a round neck and a lip at the top. The front of the bottle has the words, Wyeth & Bro, Philadelphia, with an oval surrounding the text. The inside of the bottle has some residue in it that has created a swirl pattern. And based on other research, the bottle is most likely sealed by a cork. So immediately I began researching the bottle and where it came from. I found out that Wyeth & Bro was a pharmaceutical company that began in the mid-1800s in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. They were one of the largest at the time and became well known for their invention of the pill press. So I think we, you know, all come in contact with that invention, as, you know, aspirin or any household medicines would be made with the pill press now. At the time, this was a revolutionary process which allowed for mass production and consistency of pharmaceutical products. This technology allowed them to continue to be successful for many, many years to come, and recently, in 2009, they were bought by Pfizer. After doing research on Wyeth & Bro Company, I became much more interested in what might have actually been in this bottle. What types of drugs were distributed in bottles like this? What were people's attitude towards drugs at the time? In order to find out what may have been in this bottle, I did a little research on types of drugs that were prescribed at the time. Pretty crazy to step back and look at the drugs that were used for medicinal purposes at the time. Heroin was first introduced during this time. Aspirin was also developed and was found to be the first medicine that was non-addictive. Opium and morphine were also commonly used. Any of these drugs may have been what originally occupied this medicine bottle. Even after looking at what may have been in the bottle, I couldn't find conclusive evidence that pointed to what exactly was in the bottle.
That's bad.
I know. I was a little bummed. This is where I turned, or attempted to turn, to science. Thanks to the chemistry department, the bottle was swabbed and turned over for chemical analysis. The analysis revealed that there was too much dust on the surface, you know, that swirly pattern I talked about earlier. It was just dust to know what would have really been in the bottle. So, bummer.
Well, we found it from the walls.
Exactly. There must have been dust in the walls, too. Even though it seemed to be pretty impossible to find out what used to be in the bottle, we do know that the bottle most likely came from Stout's Infirmary, which was in use from 1920s to the 1960s. The infirmary was used for a wide variety of services for ill students. In my initial research, I thought that the infirmary would have been located in Harvey Hall. However, after looking through some old issues of Stoutonia, building blueprints, and old Stout scrapbooks, it was discovered that the infirmary was actually located in a house off campus. The college nurse and her husband inhabited the home while serving the students. Mr. Plonsky was a student at the university, and his wife, Gertrude, was the campus RN. They were both in charge of maintaining the home, taking care of students, and other miscellaneous tasks on campus, such as fixing old furniture. The nurse also had an office in Harvey Hall on the second floor. So there were two separate locations. One mm-hmm. would be where they stayed, and then the office she had certain hours for. The infirmary would have been used more for serious illnesses, while the office in Harvey Hall would have been used more like a high school nurse's office. At the time, if students were sick, they could stay in the infirmary for 3 nights with no charge, since it was included in their tuition. After that, the daily rate was only $1.50, which was enough to cover their meals.
I guess they would have never felt bad about falling sick.
Right, I think people worry about that a little more now. Once I discovered the infirmary was off campus, I had to dig deeper into this facility. The house became known as the Amen House. It was a large white house that was located on 5th Street and 9th Avenue. At the time, the house was also used for the home management house. The home management house was a part of the domestic sciences program. Students in the program were required to spend 4 weeks in this house as a part of their training. In this house, they would practice techniques of maintaining a home. The program even fostered a baby to facilitate the learning of childcare.
Interesting. Does this house still exist?
It does not. I actually drove past it to see if it does, mm-hmm. but it's no longer there. Once the house was no longer used for the infirmary in the 1960s, Stout's hospitality program actually took over the space and used it for serving guests and set up a mock restaurant. You may be wondering where I'm going with all these different uses within the space. Well, this brings me to one of my most exciting discoveries. The Amen House was called the Amen House for a very specific reason. It was named after Martha Ruth Amen. Martha was head of the art department from 1949 to 1962. She was very much responsible for the transformations of the Amen House as its uses changed over time. As an interior designer, I became very excited when I found out this tidbit of information. Martha Amen was able to translate the many needs into a functional and beautiful spaces for the students. It was also quite interesting that she was never actually called an interior designer, even though I believe that she really was. I would like to think that she was a large part of making the School of Art and Design a part of what it is today.
I think you could be right on that. Because art and design, like interior design, was the first official art course.
Right, so. That and industrial design right around that time. So I think she had a part of that. I find it funny how research works. You go into it thinking you're going to, on a linear path to find answers about a specific topic, when really you end up with a web of information. I began researching a medicine bottle and ended up finding a house who was named after quite possibly the first interior design professor on Stout campus. As an interior design grad from Stout, so it was equally fascinating and kind of a little bit freaky. My classmate, Darshana, who I'm speaking to right now, her item transitions very nicely into this one, as she has chosen to study a 1930s ruler that was also found in the walls of Harvey Hall. Stay tuned to what she has to say.
Thank you.
It looks like there is so much we could get from these artifacts from the archives. The medicine bottle could have hardly been noticed during the period it existed, but now time has made it more valuable than before. Here's a similar object, which may not sound interesting, but has so much to tell us about the history of art and design at Stout. I'm Darshana Gopalakrishnan, and I will take you to Stout's historical timeline from the 1910s to 1930s through this object, the ruler. Let me first describe this artifact to you. It is an L-shaped ruler made of brass and wood from the 1920s. It is more commonly known as the Taylor Square. When you turn it on its back, you can see the markings on the wood that says Lufkin number 8132, made in USA. One of its sides is longer than the other, and it goes from 1 inch to 24 inch. The longer side also has markings for thirds, sixths, and twelfths. The shorter side of it measures from 1 inch to 14 inch and has markings for halves, fourths, eighths, and sixteenths. The brass corner brace connects the two wooden halves through four brass rivets. The markings on this ruler are still dark and clear. The Taylor Square was mainly used for pattern drafting on fabrics, but sometimes it also facilitated measuring customer dimensions, like assessing the drop of a shoulder. Simultaneous measurements of the arm heights and the thickness of the shoulder were also made possible with these rules. In pattern drafting, the right angle blade mainly helped to establish a reference line from which the other dimensions could be easily marked off.
That sounds pretty complicated for a ruler.
I know.
But it's a special ruler made for tailoring.
That's right.
Okay, got it.
The Lufkin Rule Company is the manufacturer of this Taylor Square. It was originally named as E.T. Lufkin Board and Log Rule Manufacturing Company after its founder, Edward Taylor Lufkin, and was founded in Cleveland, Ohio in 1885 and later moved to Saginaw, Michigan. It is even today one among the leading rule-making companies such as Stanley, Starrett, and Chapin Stephens. The company introduced steel measuring tapes in the 1890s. Although measuring tapes existed in England from 1868, the Lufkin Company was the first to have introduced it in the United States. England was in fact highly advanced in all kinds of measuring rules and tapes even before the other parts of the world came to know about it. Yet, the Lufkin Rule Company was known as the largest manufacturer of measuring tapes and rules in the world. Well, that doesn't tell us all about the company. There's one another interesting fact. Have you heard of the amazing story of measurement?
No.
Well, it is an advertisement booklet published by this company in the year 1949 that comically explains the history of measurement starting from the early hand measuring techniques of the Egyptians.
This is such a cool comic book, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that's what it is, kind of a comic book of sorts, right?
Sure. And I'm sure not many companies in that period would have spent so much energy on doing such a booklet, which would educate people and also advertise for their own benefit.
Interesting.
Elmer Cecil Stoner was the artist for this booklet, and from all the facts that I have, it looks like he was the first African-American to have worked on comic books. Rule-making companies of the period produced three styles of Taylor Squares. The fixed style, which is the basic form in which the arms are divided only into inches, the fixed graduated style, like this one that we have found from the archives, and the folding style, which was introduced later. In 1919, Lufkin filed a patent for folding rule. Its history states that the spring-joint folding wooden rule was one successful innovation and that it existed as a dominant measuring tool for all types of users. Takedown Taylor's squares in which one of the two arms of the square could be disconnected from the other were also available in market during this period. It was not uncommon for the tailors in the 18th to 19th century to go to their client's place to measure them. Both the takedown and folding rule made it easy to be carried by these tailors, and hence it was more preferred.
So they come to your house to measure you?
That's right.
That would be great.
If I was born in the 18th century.
Right.
The folding rule could have possibly outmoded and succeeded this particular Taylor Square. The production of this particular type of wooden ruler ceased in the 1940s. But similar kinds of L squares are being manufactured even today in steel rather than wood because of their advantages in marking out on fabric. It is just that they're not as widely used as before.
So they still use these in clothing design and tailoring?
Yeah.
What you're saying? Okay.
But they're made of steel.
Steel now.
Yep.
I got it.
So, what was the story of this ruler at Stout? In the 1970s, the Harvey Hall was being cleared for renovation. Renovation was needed partly due to safety reasons, since some elements of the building structure were falling apart. Ken Haynes, who was then a professor in the clothing and textiles department, found this tailor's square lying under one of the sewing tables in an old classroom in the second floor of Harvey Hall. He thought it was outdated for use and hence brought it to the university archives. Did you know clothing and textile has been one of the oldest domestic art course offered at the Stout Institute?
Hmm.
The archives have a collection of photographs of these classes being offered in the Harvey Hall, and I was able to look at some of these photographs of the sewing rooms and home furnishing classrooms. It also has photographs of all the equipment the building had soon after it was completed. Of these, I found the sewing tables most impressive. They were designed without pattern by Lorenzo Dow Harvey, who served as the president of Stout Institute from 1908 to 1922. He was one important member, not just in Stout's history, but in the history of art and design school, because during his service at Stout, he did all that was needed to promote all those art-related courses, and he tried to provide the maximum amenities for the home economics students.
Mm.
It was surprising to know that art and design existed right from the beginning of the Stout Manual Training School, and it was just a matter of organizing and reorganizing over the years until art and design became known to us as a distinguished department, which happened mostly around this period to which the ruler dates back. When the Stout Manual Training School began in 1891, manual training courses such as woodworking and domestic science courses such as dressmaking were the only two sets of courses offered.
What do you think they did with all the wardrobe that they created?
With the wardrobe?
Yeah, you mean like
the equipment?
The dresses and the clothing that they designed.
Well, I still wanted to know what happened to those sewing tables.
Yeah.
Because they were really good designs, I think. In 1911, the domestic science course was grouped into domestic economy department, homemakers department, and trades department, of which the domestic economy department and homemakers department were combined in 1912 to be called as the home economics department. From then, all the studio art, interior decoration, art history, clothing and textile courses were being offered under the home economics department until late 1960s, when art was designated as a separate department. Well, I hope that explains the path of art and design from the home economics department to some extent. And I'm sure Shane has many more interesting facts to tell you about the actual birth of art and design department at Stout. It definitely makes me happy to think that I belong to a department that has been blended with Stout's history. If you're still wondering how all that information relates us to the history of art and design at Stout, well, here's the answer. The ruler relates us to the history of art and design department only through the Harvey Hall. This building, with all its advanced amenities, reminds us the proud icon of Stout in its period and also our main reason for the growth of this art and design school that we are part of today. Except for the industrial arts, I would say most of the art and design courses that we have today were born from the home economics department, which was housed in the Harvey Hall. In 1911, when the Stout Institute was taken over by the state of Wisconsin, a large sum of money was appropriated for new buildings and better facilities. With that sum, the Trades Building and the Home Economics Building were erected. The Harvey Hall alone was built at an expense of $250,000, along with all advanced equipment to facilitate 500 students. It was described as one of the best arranged and best equipped home economics schools in the United States. Soon after the Harvey Hall was erected, almost all the home economics classes, including clothing and textiles, home decoration, and cookery classes, were offered in that new building. As Nicole mentioned earlier, it was initially called as the Home Economics Building. Soon after the death of Harvey in 1922, only the center room in the main corridor of the Harvey Hall was dedicated to him and was called as the L.D. Harvey Memorial. Later, with more additions to the campus, the building as a whole was renamed as Harvey Hall. This four-story building had 112 rooms. The auditorium and library was located on the first floor, the cafeteria lunch room in the basement, clothing and textile department was on the second floor, and the home furnishing and home decoration, which was supposed to be the first official art courses, was on the third floor. The locker rooms and practice cottage for homemakers department were seen as the valuable additions to the building. Harvey Hall was thus the home of home economics department from 1915 until the 1970s, and it played an important role in the growth of art and design at Stout. It is interesting how a ruler could take us back in time and give us so much information. Stout, from the very beginning, has been highly proud in showcasing its art and design-related courses, although it was not called as art and design course officially. Shortly, Drew will introduce us to his artifact, which I hope will be another proof of this fact. I'm Darshana Gopalakrishnan. Thanks for staying tuned with me.
Hi, my name is Drew Hagen. I'm a first-year MFA cinema candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. I earned my BFA in photography from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and I'm here with an interesting relic from yesteryear, a film. Well, a portion of a film. And let me just start by saying that what you're listening to now is nothing like my original vision for this project, or how it came to be, for that matter. But this happens all the time, right, with creative projects. You start something, and then upon further investigation, it becomes something else entirely. And soon the original question is pushed aside for entirely new ones. Such is the case with UW-Stout's oldest and only film, depicting the all-female cast, quote-unquote, of students attending what was then called the Stout Institute. Okay, so let's start with what I was told. I was told the film itself was essentially a propaganda piece for new student recruitment purposes. I was told that this film was made in the 1930s and that it was the quote-unquote embryo of the cinema department, the first step in the evolution of the film movement as we now know it here at Stout. To be fair, with this film, there really isn't much to go on, which forces me and the archivists, and anyone else who comes in contact with the film, for that matter, to cue Dragnet music. Speculate, which is, I do a lot of it with this, and you have to, because we really don't have much to go on, like I said before. In the beginning, I was quite excited about the film, right?
Yeah.
What secrets did this precious film hold? What enlightenment did it possess? I mean, what is its value? But in my journey towards the light, I hit some serious curves that would derail the most earnest of students. But I persevered, and we're going to break this down, all right?
Can I just say that this sounds like the most ominous film of all time?
Right? Talk about a build-up. It's like Citizen Kane reborn. But first, let's go through the history of this little film, okay? First, the film was digitized, which means scanned into a computer, in 1999 as part of a movement to save the archive materials at UW-Stout for future generations. Simple terms, it was put onto a DVD. A single DVD, by the way. And that sort of got misplaced in 2006 in the summer.
Oh.
Yeah, it sort of got...
Backup.
Yeah. Backup? Okay. So it was put on a single DVD, which became misplaced in the summer of 2016.
Fantastic.
Right. There's only one disc. We're going to digitize it, and we're going to put it on one disc, then we're going to misplace it. But these things happen, I guess, all right? So, and the disc was eventually recovered, and I was able to see this fabled film, which, at least in my mind, had, and probably yours now too, had been built up to mythological proportions.
Yeah.
Right?
You're just going to kill this for me, aren't you?
Yeah, you can see it coming, can't you?
Well,
and that was my reaction. Upon seeing it for the first time, I was a little bit crushed. I was less than blown away. The film had looked like it had been cobbled together using older film footage, perhaps more current film title cards. I'm guessing from the 1940s anyway. The titling is what I'm speculating on here. Look different, because I did research of 1930s titling, 1940s titling from big studios, and they look considerably different. Talking about font usage, typeface, excuse me, for the font nerds. Is that what we're doing? For the people who are really into typeface. Anyway, they're quite differently, and they're presented differently, too. So after much research, that's what I'm speculating, that it's something later. And quite clearly to me, it's missing an audio track.
So it wasn't a talkie, as they say.
Not a talkie, no. By the way, the film just stops at the end. There is no ending, sadly, right? So I felt at this point in my film detective career, I was left with only two distinct possibilities. The film was unfinished, or there's a second half somewhere lost in the annals of time, right, forever. Before you start crying about it, there is some hope, Shane.
Thank goodness.
Apart from its historical value, which is kind of a time capsule, right, of fashion and architecture, which you can see right away, this film was neither entertaining or educational, despite what its original makers had intended, which is also unknown. And further, we know that the film was made by the, quote, audio and visual, unquote, department at Stout. So upon viewing this little film, I'm left with more questions than answers. Who is the audience for this film? Faculty? Certainly not students, because it's not fun enough for them. If this is a compilation of previously shot footage, where's the original film? Why is it unfinished? What and where was the audio and visual department? Because it's nowhere to be found now. And why would you, the listener, or any current student, care about this little film? Most of what I've been told about the film was so speculative, it seemed like wild theory. So where was my big reveal? Where was the mysterious glowing suitcase? My research was all over the place with this. It was just all so messy. And I said, maybe I should just start over. And it was at this point that I began to realize, cue old detective music, that we might have a MacGuffin on our hands. What's a MacGuffin?
What is a MacGuffin?
Yeah, according to Merriam-Webster, a MacGuffin is an object, event, or character in a film or story that serves to set and keep the plot in motion, despite usually lacking any intrinsic importance. Did you get all that? It means nothing. It means that the film maybe has no specific message.
It's like my role in this segment of the podcast.
Not at all. Where would I be without you, Shane? Huh? I had to clear my mind of all this. So I asked the UW Stout Archives to provide me with the second oldest film in their collection so that I had some kind of point of reference to compare it to. And this film is everything you think of when you think of a classic, quote-unquote, educational film. It's the kind of sideshow-caliber footage that produces all-around yawns and inspires students to doodle or catch up on class gossip while the lights have dimmed and no one's paying attention. It goes something like this. Here we see Susie preparing to learn all about baking an apple pie. First, you must choose the right apple. Yes, a Macintosh looks like the perfect choice. Just look at the red on that apple. Yum! Now comes the preparation of that apple. And so forth and so forth. It goes on and on.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, everybody knows that voice.
Right. You've heard this same kind of narration before, except it was how little Johnny learns the Pledge of Allegiance, or how the human body digests food, or how good people sell war bonds or conserve electricity, etc., etc. It was great. Great because I knew exactly why this film existed. It had a clear purpose: to solicit future female students to come to Stout Institute to join the home economics program and bake better apple pies. What I had with the 1933 film was a detective story with very few clues. Then I found a moment of clarity in all of this by finally answering the question I had asked at the very beginning of this quest. The very first question: why is this film important to me or you? Drum roll. And the only logical conclusion that I can reach with what I've been given as a research student is its value as a time capsule. And its worth is really quite immeasurable in that regard.
That's true.
As the only surviving film from its time about Stout academia, it is the only inarguable, quote-unquote, truth of how things were on campus in the early 1940s and earlier. Again, speculation on that 1940s bit, but I think it's solid.
Right, because at least you have the footage. I mean, it's there.
Right. Sure, there are photographs and most likely other films in private hands that document that time era in Menominee about Stout. Who knows? But nothing known to the general public as to how things moved during this time period at this specific moment in time. And let's not forget that having only one of something makes it valuable. Let's not forget that either. The nameless, faceless filmmakers who made this film clip back in the 1930s or 40s, they had no idea that they would be jumpstarting an entire film movement here in Menominee, Wisconsin. The birth of the modern cinema program at UW-Stout, which, who knows, could produce the next Scorsese, Bergman, or Tarantino. Or did they?
Hello, everyone. My name is Shane Sanders. As you may have caught on, I'm a Master of Fine Arts candidate at UW-Stout. After receiving my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in Drawing and Painting at UW-Eau Claire, I decided to take my area of study to design. It appeals to my jack-of-all-trades nature, since design is connected to everything. Everywhere we look, there is evidence of design, even if we don't stop to notice or think about something as design. But just like a great work of fine art, good design has a tendency to smack you in the face so you take notice. Well, that's exactly what happened when I first laid eyes on my object that was found within the walls of Harvey Hall during its recent renovation. Much like Drew's film, it was a mystery to try and piece together why it was there and how it related to art and design at Stout at all. So, here we are in the final segment of the podcast, where I, your groovy host, will take you through the far-out 1960s to the tubular 1980s. As our quest to understand the birth of the Department of Art and Design at Stout reaches its zenith and explodes into the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. And what is this object that ties all of this research data together with terribly dated references and vernacular? A soda can. A single, beautifully designed orange masterpiece that not only perfectly illustrates what we as artists and designers do for the world, but whose timeline parallels events that would transform the very fabric of a small, state university in western Wisconsin. Events that did not happen on their own, true believers, oh no. So travel back with me in this segment as I reveal how a soda can relates to the changing landscape of art and design taught and practiced at Stout, how the vibrant community of art students and faculty strengthen the endeavor of an evolving program, and how clairvoyant vision, combined with determination and fortitude, allowed the School of Design to blossom into the well-known entity it is today. First, let's go over a little history of this amazing can I found. Although the name Sunrise referred to a soda brand as early as 1931, this particular soda comes to us from Sunrise Incorporated, located in Marshall, Minnesota. In 1956, Sunrise Incorporated purchased the rights to the name from Sunrise Bottling Company in Tazewell, Virginia, and franchised their orange beverage to Coca-Cola. It was bottled in a number of states, including Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Kentucky, Indiana, Arkansas, and Mississippi. It's a beautiful fluorescent orange can with a large white bottle cap-shaped sunburst, containing the words orange soda in the same eye-catching orange as the can. The words sunrise crown the can in white. We are also proudly reminded in an instantly recognizable mid-20th century font in the Gill, Sands, or Futura family that this product is artificially colored and preserved with benzoate of soda.
What is that?
I don't know. A preservative.
Sounds really good for you.
Yeah. The can is made of sturdy steel construction rather than aluminum and has a pull tab top.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Old school.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever used a pull tab top. For those of you not familiar with the pull tab, it was a design that dominated the market in the 1960s and early 1970s. Before the pull tab, if you wanted a soda, you had to use a can opener to open
keep
a can.
In your back pocket,
huh? Yeah, right. Yeah, you had to punch two holes in the top of the can, one to drink out of and one to let the air flow. I used to have to open my chocolate syrup for my ice cream like that when I was a kid. So one day in 1959, an engineer named Ermal Fraze went on a picnic, and he forgot to put his can opener in his back pocket, like you said.
Simple mistake.
Yeah, shouldn't have done it. After using a car bumper to open his beer, he stayed up all night until he had come up with a solution. An aluminum ring connected by a rivet to this pre-scored wedge-shaped portion of the top of the can. And so you just put your finger through the tab and pulled the ring. And when it was pulled, it removed the elongated wedge, and that allowed the beverage to pour out and the air to flow all simultaneously.
Genius.
Yeah. It was better than having to use a can opener, but after years of people turning the pull tab into sharp pieces of litter, the stay-on tab that's widely recognized today was invented. And that's no joke, because I remember as a kid going to the beach and having pull can tops laying all over the beach. So all of these clues, steel construction, mid-20th century font, and pull tab top, Along with knowing that this design is the third generation of can style, thanks to our friends at canconnection.com, leads me to believe that this can of soda was enjoyed somewhere in Harvey Hall in the mid to late 1960s, which is a perfect parallel and a great segue into the beginning of the School of Art Design at Stout. Sometime during the 1963-64 school year, a meeting took place between then-president of Stout, William J. Michaels, and Orazio Fumagalli from the art department at the University of Minnesota Duluth about heading the chair of a newfound art department at Stout. President Michaels promised Fumagalli a $2 million building and his full support. An agreement was reached, and the art department at Stout was born. Fumagalli seemed a good choice for the job. Going through his writings, you can tell that he was a dreamer, a tad eccentric, and a bit of a romantic, yet hardworking and eager to achieve the vision of a strong art and design program at Stout. When he described the early days of the department in his writings, you could tell that he recalled them fondly and was thankful for what he had a chance to build. He surrounded himself with good young talent and ensured that their needs as artists were met. Fumagalli was adamant that the instructors at Stout should be working, practicing artists, and thanks to their teaching contracts, every faculty member was to be provided with studio space to focus on their art while teaching.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was. The state of the studios might not have been so awesome, but we'll get to that.
Tell me more.
The first facilities for the art department were humble and sporadic. The department started as a locker room in the basement of Harvey Hall and expanded to empty homes and abandoned apartments for studio space. So they basically just kind of went out and grabbed whatever they could find for these faculties' art studios. The many empty houses that served as art studios were in constant danger of being torn down. And one story goes that faculty member Dion Manriquez came to his studio one morning to find that it was being demolished.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he had to plead with the crew to stop long enough for him to get his paintings out. A one-story flat-roofed leaky garage that had once been a beer depot served as the printmaking and art metal studios, and fundamentals of design students learned in a building that once served as a Baptist church. Hmm. It's at this point where a little imagination is needed on your part, dear listener. In the early 1960s America, soda is a popular beverage among young people. It's not hard to picture one or more of our mischievous or lazy students buying this orange beauty in a corner store and while guzzling it down on the way to class, enter Harvey Hall. After taking the last drink, they find the trouble of locating a trash receptacle too much effort. Happening upon a random space in the wall in which the can will fit, it is inserted, where it falls between the cracks to rest for 50 years. It could have been a hole made for an updated furnace or antiquated plumbing system, or perhaps an unfinished wall that was quickly being constructed to try and accommodate the numerous growing programs like the art department in the basement.
Maybe.
There are any myriad of situations possible in which a soda can ended up in the wall of that building. But, like Bob Ross said, however you think it should be, that's how it should be. It's your story, dear listener. You paint it however you like. But I digress. Back to the fledgling art department's journey into the unknown. In 1965-66, the art department took over the old farmer's store located on the corner of 5th and Broadway. It was going to be used by the fire department, who had already started to remodel the space, but the citizens of Menominee voted against the building being used for that purpose. The faculty got to work transforming the partly remodeled building into their new headquarters. The first floor held an exhibition gallery, a storeroom/workroom for the gallery, the art office, and five narrow faculty studios. Some real studios.
Real studios, not in the old apartment?
Yeah. The basement contained ceramics, a slide library, a drawing studio, and a sculpture studio. During the fire department's remodeling, the back quarter of the first floor was torn out so that the basement could be filled with earth to take the weight of their large trucks. It was because this never happened that the space was perfect for sculpture. It now had a ceiling that was two stories high. And this would later influence the design of the sculpture studio in the new Applied Arts building. Yeah.
Happy accident.
Yeah, right. The empty back lot of the building was used for the ceramics kiln and the sculpture furnace. The large mess of materials in the lot led President Michaels to, quote-unquote, suggest building a fence to hide the eyesore. I think they appreciated it very much. But the maintenance crew budget could not sustain a fence, so the staff were forced to ask students for help and instead. The students wanted the fence to represent the art program, so they built something unique of their own design. And this led to the construction of the infamous Funk Fence.
The Funk Fence.
Let us not forget that we are discussing the 1960s.
Makes sense.
The free love movement and drug counterculture of the day produced a mindset of openness and experimentation. The so-called funk fence that the students had constructed was inspired by a movement at the time coined funk art, whose aesthetic mirrored the free spirit of youth in the 60s and focused less on craft. Fumagalli described the fence as a spontaneous and uninhibited, honest and accurate expression of the age. Guy's great. To the untrained eye, surely the fence was a shoddy, hodgepodge collection of wooden scraps. To his credit, President Michaels shielded the art department from the outcry of the community about their repugnant fence. Although the fence was vandalized a time or two, the students simply rebuilt it, turning the damaged areas into focal points of the new composition. The fence survived for years, until the art department eventually moved into their new building. A poem was written by Bill Shulman to honor the fence. Even though both Shulman and Fumagalli had forgotten that the fence was vandalized, it made a fitting tribute.
North of the muted bottling plant, north of my Olga Breck studio, north of the bat-filled Baptist church, we filled all the niches in the old farmer's store, where Don's Super Value parking lot now stands. North of our dusty spaces, north of our acquired art center, between the chancellor's house and the fraternity house, between fantasy and practicality, between the pot shop and the sculpture shed, we built our fence of discarded aesthetic. Our fence became as mighty as Fort Snelling, as visible as Elk Mound, as representative of who we are as Alzerin Crimson and Grog. We watched as the community paid homage, shaking tongues and twitching eyebrows at our Cristo run wild. They came singly and in pairs, murmuring sotto voce about how they thought they hated it. But talk is talk and love is love. Our fence, suffering this torment, as ridiculed as Jackson Pollock, more outrageous than senseless graffiti, stood reflective, gaudy, joyful, and held its ground with grace and without a single case of vandalism. Eventually, we moved east and a bit south and lost our fence of vulnerability.
As the students left their endearing mark on the program, so too did the dedicated faculty and staff. Not only were they making an impact on the students, but their work was garnering attention from the media. In the Sunday, January 30th, 1972 issue of the Minneapolis Tribune, journalist Mike Steele wrote a piece titled Artists of the Menominee Phenomenon, in which he highlighted the young, talented staff of artists/teachers at Stout. Why are you laughing? Menominee Phenomenon is very hard to say. I bet you cannot say that five times fast.
You don't think I can?
No.
All right. Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon. Ha!
Now I feel like an idiot. Moving on. The article explained the atmosphere of the art department and showcased the philosophies and work of the teachers who were given studio space and expected to lead by example. Charles Wimmer, 1966 to 2000, painting and drawing. Todd Boppel, 1963 to 73, painting. Doug Cumming, 1967 to 2001, painting and drawing. Gerald Hanna, 1971 to 76, painting. And Rob Price, 1970 to 2009, printmaking painting, were some of those featured. While the program flourished, Orazio Fumagalli continued striving to make the program the best it could be. Around 1966-67, the seed was being planted for the School of Design. The art department received a grant, which allowed them to study how artists were being used in an industrial setting. During my research, it wasn't clear to me from whom they had received the grant, but one can assume that it was probably the state or federal government.
Most likely.
Yeah. With this grant money, Fumagalli and Mike Jerry from the art department, along with Jim Bjornrud from the School of Industrial Technology, visited companies like General Motors to learn all that they could about the process inside the large companies. They also visited independent design firms and other schools of design to discover what was being taught and what traits employers found most desirable. They learned that designers who could communicate by sketching while they talked due to strong foundations in painting and sculpture were favorite candidates of employers. Fumagalli knew then that they were on the right track. For at least 5 years after this research, the art department petitioned to add industrial and interior design to the art program.
Makes sense.
During those years of petition, President Michaels had finally made good on his promise for a permanent home for the art department. Instead of the $2 million building he guaranteed Fumagalli back in 1963, he delivered on a $4.7 million 91,000 square foot facility.
Wow.
That would more than meet the needs of the program. It was the last hurrah of President Michaels, as he soon retired, but Fumagalli would always remain grateful to the man he considered responsible for the creation of his growing program. And he really did.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Yeah, he loved Michaels. He referred to him in his writings as the Philosopher King.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Soon came a changing of the guard, and with the completion of the new Applied Arts Building, Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs Wes Vase authorized concentrations in industrial and interior design. Victory, finally. Mm-hmm. With the dream of the School of Art and Design now a reality, the new Applied Arts Building opened with large fanfare on November 17, 1973. A unique festival was held in celebration that included a marching band and ribbon-cutting ceremony. The building then held activities for the public so that people could understand the concentration of each area, including art, packaging, manufacturing, production processing, and the Center for Research and Educational Improvement. Eventually, in 1984, the building was named for the man whose vision had made it a reality, William J. Michaels. The building served the campus well, but in 1988, requests were put in for the remodeling of the building regarding purpose-built and designated design studios for growing enrollment in industrial, interior, and graphic design. While the Applied Arts Building continued to grow and change with the times, Sunrise Cola was seeing its decline in the market due to the franchising of other more popular orange sodas like Orange Crush. Only a few bottlers continued to make Sunrise past the 1980s. Although the last Sunrise soda came off of the assembly line in the Coca-Cola bottling plant of Winona, Minnesota in 2012, we are still reminded by its predecessor, who lay preserved in a wall for 50 years, that something as simple as a can of soda can help us recall events of significance if we are willing to draw lines and ask the right questions. From the Design Seminar Masterclass, this has been Discarded Design, a reflection on art in ephemera, with
Nicolette Morgan,
Darshana Gopalakrishnan,
Drew Hagen,
and Shane Sanders.